I'll ask the marshal to please call the next case as counsel starts to come forward.
Now calling case number A25-0039, Benchmark Investments, LLC, respondent versus Jennifer Mark et al., appellants.
Good morning, counsel. Take your time to... You're just fine. Take your time to get settled.
Yeah, if the VA ever gets around to replacing my knee, I'll be much better off.
As you're settling in, I'll just go over a couple of housekeeping matters. You'll each be given 15 minutes for your argument this morning. Appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And please feel free as you come up to adjust the podium, the height of the podium. There are buttons on the front, so you can make sure that it's to your comfort level. And before you begin your argument, I'll ask that you each please identify yourself and your client for the record. Counsel for appellant, when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent the appellants, Kui Tan and Jennifer Mark. The overarching problem in this case is that there are numerous factual disputes that the trial court failed to view in the light most favorable to appellants, as it was required to do in the summary judgment motion. And when those facts are properly viewed, there are disputes about at least two separate ways that Benchmark breached the lease agreement, either one of which should have excused appellant's duties to perform under the agreement. The first is when Benchmark failed to deliver the premises on the agreed-upon date, and second, by failing to deliver the entire premises on any date due to the continued storage of personal items on the property. So I think the clearest example of failing to view the facts in the light most favorable to appellants is in footnote 5 of the trial court's opinion, where it states that the record is unclear about whether they agreed to the last extension of the move-in date, but says, quote, the delayed date must have been agreed to by defendants, appellants here. And that's just turning the summary judgment standard on its head, because Tan's affidavit states in paragraphs 66 to 68 the opposite. It says Newkirk did not contact us directly or confirm that we agreed to the extension. It says we never sent any confirmation that we had agreed to extending the occupancy date to July 16th. And so if the trial court had viewed those statements from the affidavit in the light most favorable to appellants, it could not have concluded that they agreed, as a matter of law, to extend the move-in date to July 16th.
Counsel, opposition argues that even if there wasn't agreement and that were to be viewed as a breach, that last extension, the breach was cured when respondents made the keys available and a walkthrough inspection, as evidenced by your client sending relatives to do the walkthrough inspection. What do you say to the argument that any such breach was cured by those circumstances?
So there's two problems with that argument. One is that the delivery of the premises on a later date does nothing to cure the obligation to provide the premises on the date that they agreed to. And the second is that the delivery of the premises on some later date was never unconditional. The Benchmark required appellants to sign a new modified lease agreement if they wanted to move in, and that contained numerous new terms and obligations that they had not previously discussed. And I think the case law is clear, particularly in the DeRozier case, which we cited in our brief, that when you impose new conditions that were not previously agreed to, that cannot be a cure under the law.
Okay, so your response is it wasn't a cure because it was conditioned on your clients accepting new terms in the lease agreement.
Correct. Okay. And I think at the very least that whether it also goes to their argument that the move-in date wasn't a material breach, and that is a question for the jury to decide materiality and whether a difference of whatever time period we're talking about was material or not. The parties disputed that because Benchmark said they weren't planning to move in at that time anyway, and then the appellants responded, well, we weren't moving the whole family in, but Quiton was going to use it periodically during that time period. And so that, again, is a dispute of facts that the jury should have been allowed to consider to determine whether the move-in date was a material breach by Benchmark.
Isn't there some outer limit, though, on materiality where the court can decide it and just say there's no possible way this could be material? I mean, in cases, there is discussion of that. Like, this is material. This doesn't seem like it would be material. So isn't there something on the outer limits of that where you're not going to submit it to a jury because, I don't know, come up with an example. It's so trivial.
Perhaps. Theoretically, I think, if it was, 5 minutes late to deliver the premises, sure. But I think when you're talking about a move-in date for a lease, the whole point of a lease is the delivery of the premises. And so when you're talking about several days, weeks later to deliver it, that's at least got to be something that the jury, a reasonable jury can say, that's material. So I don't think that concern is present here.
But doesn't it seem like, to me it seems like your real argument is, okay, we went to do the walkthrough, our relatives did on our behalf, and all this stuff was still there that we've been asking them to remove from the get-go. Because I think the materiality and the cure, I mean, they, in writing, agreed to several continuances, and it's only this last one where they said we want a firm date in writing, and they didn't get it in writing. I mean, a jury could look at that and go, well, this really isn't material, or it was cured because you'd agreed to that the whole time, and now you're complaining about 10 more days. What's 10 more days?
Well, I think what you just said is exactly right. The jury could look at it and say that's not material, but the court can't. There's because it's disputed.
Understood.
To your point, though, the second an independent way that Benchmark breached the lease agreement was with the storage of personal items on the property. And here the parties sharply dispute how much was left behind. Appellants have characterized it as taking up entire storage areas and really impacting the way that they intended to use the property. Benchmark says, oh, it wasn't that much. It's, isolated. It's not a big deal. And that should be something that the jury should get to look at and decide, how much it would have impacted the party's expectations and whether that's a material breach.
Is there any case law in landlord-tenant? I mean, I know with short-term leases, short-term arrangements like Airbnb, you can expect that the owner's personal property is going to be it's going to be there on the property. But is there any case law about longer term leases and what can or can't be left without some kind of mention or right?
I have not found any.
Yeah.
So I think I think what it comes down to is whether it's can be considered consistent with the lease when you put in the lease that you're going to convey the whole premises and then certain areas are blocked off, and whether that's material
real
or not.
Property as opposed to real property and I'm storing my personal property there.
Yes. The trial court, of course, avoided this whole issue by relying on the as-is clause in the agreement, and I think it's notable that neither the trial court nor Benchmark has cited any case from any jurisdiction that has ever applied an as-is clause to the presence of personal property on the premises. These clauses are common, but they've always been interpreted to apply to the condition of the premises.
I ask a question? The district court noted in its order that no one had alleged that the as-is clause is ambiguous, and respondents are latching onto that, saying, well, you can't get into that here because it wasn't argued by appellants below. But the question I have is, did the district court raise that issue in the first instance? In other words, was anybody talking about the as-is clause, or is this a situation where the district court on its own went to that as-is clause and said, here's what I'm going to base my decision on?
I do think Benchmark raised the as-is clause at the trial court. So, but the issue wasn't I mean, they argued it was unambiguous in their favor, and we argued it was unambiguous in our favor.
And I note in your reply brief you dispute that it wasn't raised below and
right.
provide a cite to the record. So that is something that you or your firm argued on behalf of appellants.
Correct, yes, yes. But I think, you know, regardless, I think that the idea that an as-is clause can be applied to personal property is just legally erroneous and would really have far-reaching effects for lease agreements throughout the state if that's adopted by this court. And so once you take the as-is clause out and say it can't be interpreted that way, then you're left with is the amount of property left on the premises a material breach? And for all the reasons we've stated, that's a fact question for the jury.
So there were, if I might, there were allegations made by your client that the home was not safe for their child. So what is that based on? Is that based on the fact, well, if the child went down to the basement, there was personal property, a Benchmark there, or what was that based on?
So I'm not sure that it was fully spelled
was
out.
Was there anything in the record on that? Yeah.
I think the idea was that there was certain items stored that were like chemicals that might not be safe, and I think there was also concerns about how things were stacked that
okay.
potentially they could fall. That was the gist that I understood from the record. If there are no other questions on that, I'd just talk about the cross appeal briefly. Benchmark has cross-appealed the decision on the attorney's fees. I think the trial court considered this issue pretty carefully, considered that they were requesting several times more than the amount in controversy. It looked at the work performed and determined it was excessive, looked at the paralegal costs, decided they weren't detailed enough. All of that is reasonable analysis for the trial court to engage in. So the court should not find an abuse of discretion on that piece. Of course, this court doesn't have to get to the attorney's fees at all if it reverses the grant of summary judgment, because Benchmark is only entitled to attorney's fees if it prevails. But if the court were to affirm on summary judgment, it should also affirm on the attorney's fees issue. So if there are no other questions, I just ask the court to reverse the summary judgment and remand for trial.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Chris Boleen, counsel for respondent and cross appellant Benchmark Investments, LLC. This court should affirm the district court's judgment granting Benchmark's motion for summary judgment, and it should reverse or modify the lower court's judgment relating to Benchmark's motion for attorney's fees and costs. This is a breach of contract case involving an unambiguous residential lease. Benchmark rented a home to appellants, both of whom are highly educated individuals and sophisticated. Before this lease was to start, only one of the appellants saw it in person, and that was several months before they executed the lease, and even longer before they were to occupy that lease. One of
so
the appellants...
doesn't that, I mean, kind of help their argument instead of yours on the as-is clause? Because they saw it with, and it was furnished, right? When Mr. Tan went through the walkthrough before signing the lease.
Could you repeat your question, Your Honor? I missed just the beginning.
So was there furniture in the home, and the principal of Benchmark was still living in the home at the time that Mr. Tan went on the walkthrough?
There was furniture in the home. There was we'll call this individual a stager, someone who was
right.
taking care of the house at that point
right.
in time. So
and
there were
so and then the lease was signed at least was it in April?
Lease
so at least
yes.
a few months before the date the lease was to start.
Correct.
And So how can you draw from that this as is includes everything that was in the house? Because one would not assume when one went through a house with furniture in it that were an apartment that I was going to lease, that the furniture was going to be gone and the personal property was going to be gone. So that's my question, is the timing of all this, is how you can rely on that as-is clause. And then if you'd also address Renter's Warehouse and the representations they made as being the agent of Benchmark.
Sure. If I may, I'll talk about Renter's Warehouse first.
Sure.
They hold, I'll call them two capacities here. They start out as a facilitator in helping to find a tenant, and that's what they were doing prior to the lease being signed. And then after that, they are serving as what the lease calls as a facilitator between landlord and tenants. And the comments that appellants have referenced relating to, I believe it's a Mr. Hagman, one of the landlord or one of the Renter's Warehouse representatives, who was present during that February walkthrough. Those are parole evidence that we don't get into because it does not make its way into the contract. So if he's got a discussion, Mr. Hagman has a discussion.
But there's nothing in the contract saying that your client was going to leave personal property in the premises. I mean, it seems like you're kind of arguing out of both sides of your mouth on that question.
And the way I look at that issue, Your Honor, is that you could take this lease and you could list one rake, one shovel, one can of paint in the basement, one box fan in the attic. That lease becomes a lot longer than what it is, a lot more complicated than what, in my opinion, it needs to be.
No, that personal property would be left on the premises, you know, and... That's not so hard, is it?
I wouldn't say it's hard, but in terms of complexity, we're talking about two different documents. Okay. You've got a history here of this property for 15 plus.
Well, but Mr. Tan didn't know that.
He didn't know what?
He didn't know that personal property was going to be left on the property.
I'd argue he did. So when he signs this lease, he's bound by the contract that he signs.
Counsel, on the as-is provision, why is that unambiguous?
Well, in the first instance, it was not argued below that it was ambiguous, and we've briefed that issue in terms of whether or not that's waived.
Well, you say it wasn't argued below, but Thiel v. Stitch refers to issues that were considered by the district court in making its decision. So the district court relied on the as-is provision. Our review is de novo, and those are issues of law. So, you know, as long as the district court considered it and decided it, I don't know why it's beyond this court's scope of review, unlike the paragraph 13 issue, which no one raised, the district court didn't consider it. Those are very different circumstances. Here we have the district court saying, this is an as-is contract. No one said it's unambiguous. I say it's unambiguous, and it means personal property can be left.
Right.
I don't think that's unambiguous. If it is unambiguous, the law we've been given says that courts generally treat as is clauses as referring to the physical condition of the structure, not as to personal property left within. I'm willing to give you that the way this is worded, that being it's safe and habitable, you know, maybe raises a reasonable argument. Well, maybe this does include stuff that's left behind and how it impacts. But what that does is create an ambiguity. So then why wouldn't we look to the conversations between renters Warehouse and the appellants here?
So the language of that particular provision has what I would say three parts, and we focus on the first two. The comments about being in good repair, it's safe, it's clean, you find those in the first sentence of this paragraph. That's paragraph 10 of the lease. The second sentence says, furthermore, by signing this lease, tenant acknowledges and agrees that it has taken the premises as is, unless otherwise noted in the lease.
So does that mean, did the lease then say, please note all the furniture that was on display was for staging purposes, therefore it shall not be included with the property?
It does not refer to staging furniture.
Okay, so why didn't you leave the staging furniture? I mean, your argument is that as is means what did you see when you walked through that day? if you're saying, well, they saw stuff in the rafters, stuff in the attic, stuff in the garage, they also saw it nicely staged. Why didn't they get use of that furniture?
Our argument about the as-is clause is that what they are getting, when they get there, that's what they're getting. That's
well,
what they're taking.
Well, I just said, when they got there, oh, you're saying as-is. So when they show up to take possession, if there is like a cesspool in the living room, that's as-is because it was there when they got there?
I wouldn't take it to the extreme of sort of something that would violate licensing restrictions for a rental property. There are limits to this, and that's why I say there's a backstop to this.
Do you have any case law saying that as-is clauses have been interpreted to apply to physical property left behind that's not mentioned in the lease?
We do not have any cases that touch on personal property or landlord items in the residential leasing
but
context.
But the other side has cited case law that says as-is clauses generally refer to the physical condition of the structure. So doesn't that at least suggest that this is not unambiguous?
Our argument here is that the parties chose the language in this extensively negotiated lease, and they are bound to that regardless of whether or not we have a case in the residential leasing context where you have a discussion on personal property or not. And again, I think the issue here is also that there are protections in place should something get out of bounds. You have statutory covenants of habitability in 504B. You have overview or oversight by the city of Minneapolis because this is a rental property. So it needs to be licensed. It needs to be inspected. There are certain codes that need to be met. The way this works is that you've got a landlord who shows a very nice property to an individual, and then they've got a lease that they negotiate for several months before it's signed, and in that lease, the tenants are invited to say, hey, you've seen this property, you agree it's safe, you agree it's clean, and then you agree that when you get here, you're going to take it as it is.
Maybe they agree it's safe and clean in the sense that, you know, walls aren't falling down, pipes aren't leaking, and they're agreeing to take it in that safe condition. But again, that goes to the physical structure.
Correct.
The mechanics and these other things.
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, reasonable people could also walk through a property and recognize that, well, all this furniture is not going to stay because it's not in the lease, nor is all this personal property going to stay because it's not in the lease. Isn't that a reasonable interpretation of the clause?
I think,
under your theory of as is?
I think the language, unless otherwise noted in this lease, makes it so that that argument doesn't work in this context.
So why wasn't the staging furniture noted?
In terms of being something that was going to be removed?
No, yeah, or left behind, since it wasn't noted as something that was going to be removed.
The staging furniture could have been there, right? I mean, they're taking that property as is once they step foot into it, once that lease starts.
Understood. Thank
right.
you.
Your Honor, given the time that I've got, I would like to move on to the attorney's fees issue, but before doing so, I want to make sure that I answer any other questions that that the panel would have relating to the appellant's arguments on prior breach or other issues.
Well, I just have one question about their other argument about the material breach of the move-in date. It seems like there is evidence in the record, at least through emails, of an agreed move-out date of July 8th, but then the district court kind of made the assumption that since there were further communications or they showed up later, that it had actually been pushed back to July 16th. Why wasn't the district court's footnote there kind of essentially resolving an issue of fact?
As to whether
there was an agreement.
In our reading of the district court's opinion, they had looked at, or the district court's order, they looked at a fairly voluminous record here where you've got a 96-paragraph affidavit from Appellant Tan. You've got exhibits exceeding 30 or 40 attached to Mr. Tan's exhibits, many emails, a very robust history of how the tenants and Benchmark Investments interacted leading up to the end of this relationship. And throughout that, you had emails. You had an email saying, we're going to move the move-in date to July 1st. You have emails about moving it
but
to July.
But how is that not a fact issue? I mean, whether it was a material breach or not, it's another question. but there the emails say if I get a response back today or if I get something, you know, then I'll consider it. And there's nothing in the record to say that there was an agreement. And we've got Mr. Tan's affidavit expressly saying the opposite, that he did not agree. So that is a fact issue, isn't it?
The problem with that is that his affidavit contradicts itself. I mean, when you've got this...
Where?
Evacuate...
Like how, so we should invalidate paragraphs, I think Ms. Cole said it was 66 through 68. So which paragraphs contradict that he agreed to the...
So
in July 30th or whatever date.
In Appellant Tan's affidavit, you have references to conduct such as setting up utilities to start on July 16th, sewer, water. You have them setting up lawn care with a vendor for July 16th. You have an initial move-in that was to be occurred on July 16th. You have them
so
receiving...
So it's okay for the court to just assume despite evidence to the contrary. I mean, I guess that I don't know how you get around that being a fact issue. It's another issue whether this was material or not, but...
Right, and I think the way that the court looked at this is, and I don't make light of it, is that they took a common sense view of all this evidence that was before it. And they looked at the conduct of appellants before and after that.
The court found that fact.
The court's
in
orders
essence, on a summary judgment motion. Now, whether it's material or whether it's this or that, that's a whole other question.
The court said that they did not make any findings of fact. They're basing
Well, the court said that at the beginning, but then said...
The court did make findings of fact. Yeah. I'm listening to your argument. It's a good argument for the jury. It's a very persuasive argument. It's like, well, they're claiming that this was a material breach, because, you know, they demanded an answer on July 3rd. They didn't get it. We delivered possession or attempted to on the July 16th. They said a representative had appellant on the FaceTime screen, looked around, had set up utilities. All of that is circumstantial evidence indicating that although appellants didn't get their written answer on July 3rd like they demanded, they nonetheless agreed to this July 16 date. It's a very easy argument to make, but the problem is the district court is not supposed to resolve factual disputes on summary judgment or make determinations based on inferences from circumstantial evidence. I mean, that's the step too far.
Correct.
And I don't know, and I hear what you're saying. Well, there's only one obvious conclusion. I mean, maybe then it does go to you on the theory that it's a genuine issue of material fact. It has to be reasonable. There's no way two reasonable people could look at these circumstances and view it one way or another. But it's pretty close. And if it's close, we're supposed to assume the facts in the light most favorable to the person who's opposing summary judgment, are we not?
If there are genuine issues of material fact in dispute, Your Honor, correct. You are resolving those issues in favor of the non-moving party. I see my time is up. Before I step down, are there any other questions from the panel I can answer?
Just one, if I might.
Mm-hmm. Please.
And that's on the attorney's fees. So do you have a case that actually says that the level of detail of findings are required by the district court? Because the district court wrote a pretty robust order there, I would think, and the case law actually talks about a concise statement of the reasons, not a line-by-line detailed discussion. So is there any other case law that we're missing there?
The case I would point the court to is Shepherd versus City of St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
That's 380 Northwest 2D 140. The specific issue quoted from that case on appeal was, did the trial court err when it substantially reduced the amount claimed without making specific findings on the hourly rate allowed and the number of hours considered? And then the Court of Appeals directed the district court to demonstrate the calculations made to arrive at that amount, the reasonable rate multiplied by reasonable hours. Underlying that, you have the six Paulson factors that get to the reasonableness of the cumulative fee request, right? So in Shepard, you have specific language where the court says it was an abuse of discretion not to provide a full explanation as to the number of hours and the hourly rate permitted. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Benchmark argues that the trial court was correct to assume that the appellants had agreed to the July 16th move-in date because they had set up utilities to start on July 16th. I think that's wrong. When they said that they did not agree to the move-in date, and then the response is, well, Benchmark is not going to provide you the premises until July 16th. I'm not sure what the trial court expected appellants to do. I mean, all they could do was acquiesce, right, and set up the utilities to start on the day that the premises were given to them. It's not like they could have forced their way into the premises before July 16th if Benchmark said that it's not available. But that doesn't mean they agreed or were willing to agree to change the move-in date. That just means that Benchmark didn't provide access to the premises before that date. In addition to Judge Larkin's point about whether the as-is clause is ambiguous, I think if the court wants to go there and view it as ambiguous, it makes our argument even easier because then you look at all of the communications between appellants and Renters Warehouse and Mr. Newkirk about whether the items would be removed. And Renters Warehouse was very clear that they would be removed unless something in the contract said that they could stay. There was a comment made about characterizing Renters Warehouse as a facilitator. I'm not sure if that was supposed to be opposed to an agent, but that argument was not made in the briefing. The lease agreement refers to Renters Warehouse as an agent. And certainly throughout these negotiations, they were acting that way, and Benchmark should be bound to the statements made by Renters Warehouse with regard to whether the items would be removed or not. I also want to point out that it wasn't just Renters Warehouse. There was a couple of communications with Newkirk himself where appellants reiterated that the items should be removed, and he really never objected to that until things finally came to a head sort of at the breakdown of their relationship. And so that's something that the court should look to as well. Throughout the parties' communication.
I'm just thinking about the as-is clause. You know, in the context of, I'm thinking of like home sales as opposed to landlord-tenant. And this is just anecdotal, so, but, you know, when you think of a sale of a home as is, I would think that it comes with whatever's in it, whatever's in that storage closet, that storage thing out back, or, you know, you're selling, I'm just wondering, like, is there something special about landlord-tenant law and how we should think about the as-is clause as opposed to other kinds of contracts that may include, like, we're selling this as-is, whatever's in there is, you know, we're not going to clear it out.
I'm going to piggyback on that because I was having the same thought about, you know, generally in a purchase for residential real estate, you have the standard clause that the realtors all use that say all personal property shall be removed. Here's what's a fixture and stays, everything else shall be removed. So we don't have that clause here saying remove all your personal property, but is it different because this is a rental agreement and not a purchase agreement? I think that's along the lines of your question.
Yeah. I think that, I don't think it, well, I guess it depends. My experience with selling homes sounds like it might be a little bit different than your experience. But that aside, I think at most, it would make it ambiguous, in which case we look to the communications where they say, where Renter's Warehouse says it's got to go unless it's specifically stated. And it would also raise the issue that Judge Larkin raised earlier of if it is as is with everything in it, then what happens to the staging furniture? And so I think when you have to look at it in a way that a reasonable person would interpret it, which in specifically in landlord-tenant, especially, you typically expect those items to be removed.
Go ahead. I'm just wondering if there's a way, like in landlord-tenant or in this contract, I mean, something about how we interpret as the language with respect to who drafted it or not. Does that play in to how we should look at this contract?
Sure. I mean, certainly that is, there is the general law that contracts are interpreted against the drafter. And here I think it's pretty clear the drafter was Benchmark or Renter's Warehouse. So you could look at it that way. That's another reasonable way that the court could look at the issue.
Judge Larkin, did you have another question?
I do not.
Thank you,
counsel. The case has been submitted, and we will issue an order within the time prescribed by statute. Thank you.